four, five, six.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Rufus Wainwright lives and sings well outside the pop mainstream. Here's one of his latest cuts, Gay Messiah.
He will then be reborn from 1970s porn, wearing tube socks with style and such an innocent smile. Better pray for your sins. Better pray for your sins. 'Cause the game coming. He will fall from the stars, Studio 54, and appear on the sand of Fire Island shore. Better pray.
Most music falls pretty neatly into one category or another. When they start inventing or reviving categories for you, you know you're on your own road. Rufus Wainwright has a lush, theatrical sound that invokes Cabaret, Tin Pan Alley, even Edith Piaf, and a throwback crooner's voice that moves through orchestrations from Baroque to pop. Son of the offbeat, confessional folky Loudon Wainwright III and French-Canadian singer-songwriter Kate McGarrigal, Rufus grew up in a musical family. He began piano at 6 and was touring with his mother by 13. Now out with his third album, Rufus Wainwright has a powerful confessional streak himself in music that sounds familiar and like nothing you've ever heard at the same time. Tonight on Point, crooner, confessionalist, eclectic, Rufus Wainwright. He joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Rufus.
Hi.
Hi, it's great to have you. The track we've been listening to has just been released online through iTunes. Why did you come out with it that way, not on a crisp,
a little
hard CD?
I don't know why. I think that these days, just with technology shifting so quickly and what the public is doing, I don't know, people are going to iTunes. That sort of just seems to be the way it's shifting in terms of releasing, like, as opposed to releasing hard copy stuff. I mean, I do expect to release Want To as a hard album and even release it on vinyl, and I do believe in that process. But in terms of, like, actual tracks, I think it's just faster to get it out there.
So this is a foretaste, in a way, of the second part of your two-disc album. Want One is out as of last year. Want Two is coming.
Yeah, it's coming.
Right along with The Gay Messiah. I have to say, right from the start, first, I'm just a big fan of your music.
Oh,
it's just terrific.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And being of the generation that I am, it's doubly fascinating for me because, you know, years ago I listened to your mother and your father.
Yeah.
And so now to triangulate from those two and find you, to hear you, to see you sitting here today is...
Yeah, cool. There's a funny story where I was doing this AIDS benefit for Elton John's AIDS, one of his AIDS charities, and one of the things that we decided to do is to sing One Man Guy, which is a song by my dad that I had covered on my second album, but we did a version of it with Elton, my father, and I. And they had known each other in the 70s.
Of course.
Elton had actually been a huge fan of and was a huge fan of my dad's work. And we walked into the room, into the backstage area, and Elton was there. And I don't think my father and Elton had seen each other for a
long time.
For like 15, 20 years. Yeah. And we sat there, and the three of us, and Elton, all he said was, he looked at my dad and he said, "This is so weird."
I can believe it. I can feel it.
Yeah,
and what a great song and cover is, One Man Guy. We'll hear some of that later.
Okay.
But we started out, you know, like your dad. And like yourself, you can be tremendously confessional, tremendously provocative at the same time.
Yeah.
Gay Messiah coming out.
Yeah.
It's funny and in your face at the same time. I love the part we heard. He will then be born from 1970s porn, wearing tube socks with style and such an innocent smile. I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, no, well, I mean, I think that, I don't know, there's a certain fine line that you have to sort of walk along between, you know, comedy and tragedy and poetry. You know, I guess that's poetry, and I try to sort of mix in a lot of different elements. I mean, and certainly, you know, on one hand, it's kind of a funny line, like he'll be reborn from 1970s porn and, you know, wearing tube socks with style. But then on the other hand, you kind of think, okay, like a lot of those gay people, you know, in those old porn movies are probably dead,
right?
You know, and that there was, you know, AIDS and stuff, and so, or there is AIDS, sorry, and so there is sort of a darker. I try to put a bit of dark meaning behind.
And you got this line, and we, I guess we understand why. As I've prepared for sitting down with you, you write, "No, it will not be me, Rufus the Baptist, I be."
Yeah,
I mean, there is a kind of a super celebrant fan club for Rufus Wainwright out there that makes you into a tremendous gay icon.
Yeah.
Artist, you know, sort of icon of that world. How do you feel about
that? Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that on one hand, it's kind of interesting because I am publicly one of the first openly gay from the outset.
Have been since your early teens.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, more in terms of like when I signed my record contract.
I see. So there's no surprise,
there was
no closet
there was never,
here.
There was never any pretext or whatever to being straight. So that's interesting. I mean, that's just more of a social phenomenon. And we'll see how that plays out. But on the other hand, you know, I come from a long line of really incredible gay writers and musicians.
Sure.
I mean, there's a history in art of gay people that is so incredible. And I would argue even, you know, one of the cornerstones of art and culture is homosexuality. I mean, you could argue, or that a lot of it happened in that world. So I don't, as far as the pressure of being an artist in that way or being thought of in that canon, I don't really, I mean, I want to be.
You clearly, you know, embrace it and are embraced in that vein.
Yeah.
I mean, let me ask you, you're being facetious, but at the same time, as you say, tragic and more, just a blunt question, you're having fun here, but do you think the world needs a gay messiah?
Well, I think, I it's interesting, because I did write that song as a kind of joke, and it came to me in a lighthearted way. But then, oddly enough, you know, a few months ago when I was touring, two things really coincided. One being The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson was released, and there was this, you know, huge Jesus, you know,
uproar,
whatever that going on. And then also at the same time, there was, you know, President Bush trying to, and the Republicans trying to amend the Constitution and ban gay marriage. Right. You know, the first time that they would add bigoted legislation to the Constitution, or well, whatever.
Right into the Constitution.
Yeah, right, you know, whereas usually that stuff should be taken out. So those two issues really coincided. And this song, essentially, in the title, deals with those two issues. And so I said, well, I'll just put them together. And it kind of became a bit of a rallying call, at least for that in that period.
Your father, Lawton Wainwright III, left your mother, Kate McGarrell, and you when you were three.
Yeah. And well, to be fair, they both kind of left each other.
I mean, well, fair enough.
Yeah.
But in any case, you got separated from your dad at that point.
Yes.
And that fact seems to inform so much of your singing.
Yeah.
Maybe your character. There's a just heartbreakingly beautiful song on here called Dinner at 8.
Yeah.
Well, you describe it. It's about a fight you had with your dad, Loudon.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an amazing song in terms of how it was created and how it kind of returned after its creation, because I wrote it years ago. I wrote it while I was writing stuff for Poses, my second album.
And after your first album came out, you did a photo shoot at Rolling
and
Stone.
And after my first album had been released, you know, my dad and I did a photo shoot together for Rolling Stone, and it just degenerated quickly after
the
that.
The evening turned into a big fight over dinner.
Just about, you know, I'd said something like, oh, well, I got you back into Rolling Stone magazine, and then in the photo, you know, I looked a lot, you know, sort of fresher, and he was nervous about it, and then that night we had a huge fight, and then we didn't talk to each other for 6 months, and then I wrote this song.
Let's listen. Rufus Wainwright's Dinner at 8.
No matter how strong, I'm gonna take you down with one little stone.
Wainwright's Dinner at Eight, a song he wrote after a fight with his father, Loudon Wainwright III. Rufus, I mean, this just listening is like a dagger in the heart of any father yeah. who has left his children.
Yeah.
How has your father? I mean, I know he says he loves it. It's beautiful. Yeah. Okay, artistically, but you got your finger right on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is that, you know, at the time when I wrote this song, it was sort of intended as a jab and as a kind of retaliation to what happened. But in the end, when I switched the line around, you know, you left me, and then at the end, instead of saying you left me, I say you loved me, and it really turns the whole song into kind of a love song. So it is a desire to sort of reconnect, which I didn't realize at the time when I wrote the song. I really kind of wrote it as this sort of bomb and then forgot about it for a few years.
He's still your father. You're still the son.
Yeah.
Is that dangerous gap still there, Rufus?
Oh, yeah. No, it's always volatile. I mean, my dad and I are very similar, and we're very, very kind of, I don't know, I was listening to one of his records last night, actually, album number 3. No one can describe what he does either. I mean, he's pretty indescribable and pretty unique, and we definitely share that trait. So we need each other more than we need to, like, destroy each other.
We're talking tonight with singer-songwriter Rufus Wainwright. We'll go into the break with a track from his upcoming CD, Want To. It's one of 4 songs from the CD that are currently available on iTunes. Here is The Art Teacher. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
There I was in uniform, looking at the art. I tell him it was him. Oh, I wish I could tell him. Oh, I wish I could have told him.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Rufus Wainwright and listening to Cigarettes and Chocolate Milk from his second album, Poses.
Cigarettes and chocolate milk, these are just a couple of my cravings. Everything it seems I like's a little bit stronger, a little bit thicker, a little bit harmful for me. If I should buy jelly beans, have to eat them all in just one sitting. Everything it seems I like's a little bit sweeter, a little bit fatter.
Rufus Wainwright's outsized appetites, cigarettes and chocolate milk, just the beginning there.
Yes.
In the months, I guess years after your second album, Poses, you went through what later became quite well-known, even famous period of disarray.
Yes, yes.
Excess of every kind, you know, liking things a little bit stronger, a little bit harmful for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You write about and have talked about the drugs that came to sort of soak your life at that time.
Yeah.
And you describe yourself as ending up in a kind of a drug-fueled, to use your words, gay hell.
Yeah.
What happened? What was it? What was going on?
Well, I think there was a combination of many things. I mean, I was, on one hand, I had spent my entire life really relying on public approval and success in my work to kind of, you know, gauge my own worth and happiness. And
many people do. You think, to a greater extent than most in your case?
Well, I think with artists or musicians, there's just a real that there's sort of this daily barometer,
yeah,
you know, because
yeah.
you know the you know and the, whether it's record sales or applause or you know how I look in this photo shoot, mm-hmm. it's always being monitored. Mm-hmm. So that I was in that state. Also, I had made a conscious decision when I made Poses, my second album, to kind of unleash myself into that demimonde, that dark mm-hmm. world, mm-hmm. which was really fun and really great for a while. And I think it's kind of, for a lot of artists, kind of a necessary place to go.
How old were you then?
I was, you know, 25.
And you were in New York?
Yeah, I was in New York, mm-hmm. and 26. And 25, 26. And then I, you know, and I did that, and I really got a lot out of it.
You told the New York Times there were a lot of boogie nights moments with 20 naked people in my apartment and me in my bathrobe playing cigarettes and chocolate milk. And I mean, let's not, let's not varnish this thing.
We're talking later.
Meta-amphetamines and ecstasy and
well,
coke and the
I
whole...
Well, I just didn't know. I think what happened is that I had originally sort of planned to sort of document, you know, my experiences in a very kind of antiseptic way and write an album about it.
And then that old experience got you around the throat.
Yeah, and then little did I know. I mean, it's interesting because actually the song Poses, which mm-hmm. is the title track of the second album, I wrote that about someone else. I mean, there was sort of another character that I was writing about. Little do I know. I mean, the lyrics fit precisely my own life. But when I talk about the gay hell thing, I mean, I do... That has caused a bit of controversy in terms of... how people have read it. I mean, certain, you know, real conservative right-wing people have sort of used that as this sort of emblem of, oh, you see, you know, being gay is, you know, it is bad.
You mean not just about Rufus Wainwright that period of searching, but about all gays all the time.
Yeah, it was put out by, like, the Concerned Mothers of America. I mean, they used it as sort of this example, which I wasn't so happy about because they didn't sort of read into what I was talking about.
As an emblem for all gay life, no. Though you would be concerning most any mother at that moment.
Yeah,
Rufus,
I mean, it's
drug-fueled anonymous
it's
sex.
It's a hard road to cross, line to walk, sorry, because it is, on one hand, you know, I do believe it is specific to only certain gay men's experience, you know, mm-hmm. that it happens to some and not to others, mm-hmm. and it's not all gay life encapsulated. But on the other hand, it is very, very prolific. There's a lot of drugs in the gay world, and there's a lot of hedonistic behavior, which is very dangerous. And you know, it's something that I think the gay world itself has to kind of come to terms with.
And
at
why the drugs?
And sometimes they don't because and there's a very good reason, because if they do, then they're immediately branded.
Of course.
You know, by society. So it's a tough world to look at. So
and the drugs, because they feel threatened by social inhibitions, or because they've got wounds that they're dealing with,
my experience, and I can only speak from my experience, was that, you know, with a drug like crystal meth, which, you know, I wouldn't talk about my experience with other drugs much, you know, I wouldn't, only because I do think it is a private issue, mm-hmm. and so forth. But with the exception with crystal meth, because I do really think that it is plaguing the gay community right now, and that it is something that, you know, whether you're an addict or not an addict or recreational, whatever, it's just you shouldn't go anywhere near it, because
it'll eat you alive
immediately, and it is so Especially for gay men, it really just hits, I believe that it really hits this nerve that has been so oppressed for years. And so, you know, all of the years of safe sex, the years of fear of AIDS, it just sort of reverses that whole.
Blows it away and off you.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very, very dangerous. And I don't even, you know, on one hand there's disease and so forth. But on the other hand, I think it's even more dangerous mentally, you know, in terms of what it does to your own sort of idea of what sex is, and you know, and what love can be, you know. It's just it's very dark and powerful drug.
How did you reach bottom? How did you turn it around?
I didn't do it a lot. I did it regularly at times, and each time you do it, you kind of do it for like five days, and you know, you
the whole
just
bender
drop out. Some people do it all the time. I mean, whatever. I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not going to put myself on a graph here. But
you ended up drying out for a month.
Needless to say,
I ended up
blind for an hour.
Ouch.
And weeping, and also, you know, seeing people in the corner hallucinating, like horrible, you know, sights, and really had a couple of seconds where I wasn't sure if my mind was going to return from its, you know, nether travels, and I knew, you know, at that moment that the party was over for me. So
you went into a center for
went
to work on the latest album.
Yeah, I went away, and it, for me, as soon as I go to rehab, you know, that's sort of where I end that talk, because after that, you know, it's like my own business. But I would say that I went to rehab, and it was actually the best thing I ever did. And anybody who thinks that they need to go to rehab should probably go to rehab, and it's great. I love rehab.
Get going.
Yeah.
We're happy to say you came out with mind and heart and sense of humor intact. Let's listen to another cut from Want One. This is Vibrate, and a happy song and a sad song.
Yeah.
Vibrate, Rufus Wainwright.
My phone's on vibrate for you. Electro clashes karaoke too. I tried to dance Britney Spears. I guess I'm getting on. My phone's on vibrate for you. God knows what all these new drugs do. I guess to have no more fears, but still I always end up in. My phone's on vibrate for you, but still I never ever feel from you. Pinocchio's now a boy who wants to turn back into a toy.
Rufus Wainwright's Vibrate. Wow, so many wonderful questions that come out of this. First of all, that opening, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
So operatic.
Yeah.
We know you've been an opera fan, buff, you name it, since your youth.
Yeah.
Giuseppe Verdi, your guy, the Traviata, Rigoletto, and all the rest.
Yeah.
Where does opera sit in the middle of your whole pastiche of Baroque and
Timpanelli?
Well,
opera for me is really the bone of my body of work. I kind of, I had a serious religious experience with it when I was quite young. I mean, I was 14, and,
describe it.
I had had, a healthy distaste for the genre and didn't get it at all and thought it was weird. And until one night, I listened to a great recording of Verdi's Requiem with Leontine Price and UC Burling, and some other Puccini arias sung by UC Burling and tenor arias. And I don't know, just after that night, I was completely hooked and completely it was almost like opera itself had come out and chosen me, you know, instead of the other way around. And I would go alone a lot. I would go. I know, and I still get that every time I go. I really feel that it's the one, the opera house for me is the one place where I can kind of believe in the eternity of life, you know, and of love and of emotion, and how there's no kind of, you know, just life, everything goes on, you know.
I know exactly what you mean. And I couldn't agree more. Why Verdi?
Verdi is interesting because he's, you know, on one hand, I'm a big German opera fan, and I love modern operas. And you know, Verdi is not always, you know, he can be a little dated at times. So I'm always amazed at how pertinent his operas can get. But needless to say, I love him because on many levels. One being his the progression of his career, I find fascinating.
He just kept writing,
and each opera that he wrote, and he wrote a lot, each one kind of got incrementally better and better and better and better up until his last one, which was
Falstaff,
which is great. But I mean, I love Otello. Like, for that, me, that's really his sort of masterpiece. And he was, you know, old when he wrote that. Yeah. So I love that progression of his career. I also love his moral sensibilities. He always had a really, I don't know, I love, he had a real kind of, he just seemed like a real mensch, basically. Like, he had like a sense of morality that I enjoy. Because sometimes opera can get a little masochistic, a little sexist, a little, you know, which his operas can get as well. But he always had this good moral sense. And also, he was just, I don't know, his sense of melody is so deep, you know, and beautiful.
And you don't hesitate to draw heavily from that world, but at the same time, in a very contemporary way, you're eclectic. You draw in all kinds of things. How do you draw the Rufus Wainwright thread through all these pieces, the sort of the opera and Verdi and Tin Pan Alley Cabaret? I mean, you've got the sort of Edith Piaf, Al Jolson, even Judy Garland references.
I think a lot of it has to do with my voice. I was very fortunate to be born with this kind of Jurassic voice that kind of requires an appetite, you know, of you know, raw material.
I mean, for the big Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
Mom says what Rufus is somewhere over the top.
Somewhere over the top.
Correctly.
Yeah. I don't know. I really require. I love to sing difficult things. I was thinking I'm kind of like the Paganini of songwriters. You know, I don't expect a lot of people to be able to sing my songs. They're very difficult. I'm not here to write, like, I was doing singing a lot of Leonard Cohen song recently. Those are so amazing because they're so simple and direct. I don't write songs like that. I have to sort of satisfy this sort of queen of a voice that I have.
and you sit and lay down so many tracks. I mean, it's just deeper and deeper and deeper with tracks. Is that in the studio?
I don't know where, and in my head, and in life. Life has many tracks.
Do you use? are you a synthesizer guy? Do you have 100 musicians there? Is it a combination?
Well, we have a lot of. Well, I'll say this. There's a song on my record. I don't know what it is. It's called I Don't Know What It Is, and it's the second track on Want One. And my producer, Marius DeVries, who's worked with Madonna and Bjork and Massive Attack and lots of people in the pop world. It's the largest song he's ever mixed. I mean,
largest, like, in the number of tracks.
Yeah, number of tracks. That wasn't on that track specifically, but like on some, there's like 350 vocal parts. And
so even after Bjork, he's never done.
Which, you know, I'm not necessarily proud of that. I think I might be overcompensating a little bit, but hey, someone's got to do it.
Yeah, it's a terrific song. What do you think old Giuseppe would think if he could spring to life and hear the way his opera's been taken into this place, where Rufus Wainwright goes?
I mean, within my, how I regard it, I mean, I think he has it's such a beautiful but kind of sad story, because he lost his wife and two children when he was very young. I mean, when he was in his 30s, I think, kids, or late 20s, and you know, they died of, I don't know, whatever people died of those days.
Consumption.
Yeah, something like that. And it always sort of tainted his writing. And he's very dark. But then the last opera he wrote was a comedy. And there's just stories about him. And he always was kind of, you know, troubled to write and found it this kind of difficult thing to do. But he did it. But at his last in his last days, he was always like, oh, I wish I could just, you know, be alive and write one more opera. Because he kind of realized at the end how great it was, you know, writing. And
that's the way you'd like to go out. Anybody would like to go out.
So I think he would just be happy.
It's terrific. We're talking tonight with Rufus Wainwright. Let's go out of this segment with his cover of his father's song, One Man Guy, from Loudon Wainwright III. Not always an easy relationship, but it sounds good in the cover.
Yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
People know when they see this show the kind of a guy I am. They'll recognize just what I stand for and what I just can't stand. They'll perceive what I believe in and what I know is true. And they'll recognize I'm a one-man guy with what's through and through. People meditate, that's just great, trying to find the inner you. People depend on family and friends and other folks to pull them through. I don't know why I'm a one-man guy, why I'm a one-man show. But these 3 cubic feet of bone and blood and meat are all I love and I'm a one-man guy in the morning, same in the afternoon. One-man guy when the sun goes down, I whistle me a one-man tune. One-man guy, one-man guy, only kind of gotta be. I'm a one-man guy, I'm a one-man guy, one-man.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest is Rufus Wainwright. His musical style has been called everything from Baroque pop to operatic. This is the opening track from his latest album, Want One, entitled Oh, What a World.
Men reading fashion magazines. Oh, what a world it seems where you live in, straight men. Oh, what a world we live in. Why am I always on a plane or a fast train? Oh, what a world my parents gave me always. Traveling, but not in love. Still, I think I'm doing fine. Wouldn't it be a lovely headline like this? Beautiful on the New York
Rufus Wainwright's Oh, What a World from his most recent album, Want One. Talk about layering. There it is again. It's terrific.
Yeah.
And you later move on into this whole segment with Ravel's Bolero and things.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
But the lyrics are always right there, so full of attitude. And you know what, Rufus, I can't help it again, having grown up with Loudon Wainwright in my ear.
Right.
You know, when I hear his son singing Oh, What a World My Parents Gave Me,
right.
When I'm always traveling but not in love, if I got that right. What do you think about that inheritance, if you will? That, I mean, both your parents were icons of a certain period, and were living, in a way, in what they helped shape. What do you think of the inheritance?
I mean, I very much believe that music is, there is at times, a lot of times, a heavy-duty genetic component involved. You know, I was watching Judy Garland the other day, of course. God, I gotta get out of that. But you know,
there's hell again.
Yeah, help! I'm in gay hell. And there was, you know, and there's just this shot of her, and it's Liza Minnelli. You know, it's there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's just certain
it.
Moments. You're like, whoa! And I think that really happens a lot. I mean, my sister's an amazing singer and songwriter, and my mother's. Sings with her sister and my father's sister is a singer. So it's all it's very heavy in the genes.
So when you say, "Oh, what a world my parents gave me," you're really thinking about the musical inheritance that sort of
Well, needless to say, a lot of my own sort of comeuppance in the world this last couple of years has really had to do with the fact that, you know, you kind of have to accept your parents for who they are, and you have to kind of put down a lot of the resentments and say, you know, what can I take from them that will help me survive?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
let's look through
they've survived.
Chest here. Yeah.
They've survived, and I need to survive, and I need, you know, some of these aspects. You know, I got to take what I can use.
So tell us, what are you using, man?
Well,
I mean, everybody needs to know.
Well, certainly from my father, I've learned a lot. And one of those things is that, you know, a lot of the sort of anger that I had towards him regarding the fact that he was so selfish and that he was so kind of distant, I've come to realize that he really had to be that way at a certain point in his life. He had to kind of... He had to skip out, you know, and really
to protect
himself, or to, you know, to sort of really maintain his own spirit, you know, and however painful it was, it was a step that he had to go through to sort of, you know, for self-preservation. And I think that's something that you can kind of learn from your parents is that. Well, it's great when you start learning things from your parents that have nothing to do with them being parents. Has more to do with them being
Here's
people.
The human.
You know, and music, you know, is only really the tip of the iceberg for that relationship that I have with them.
It's terrific. So. You wrote a song called 11:11.
Yeah.
And you say you went through a time when you were just noticing every time you glanced at your watch or a clock, it was 11 past 11.
Yeah.
But you ended up writing it about New York and a more famous 9/11.
Yeah,
you grew up largely in Canada, but have spent recent years in New York. Tell us about this song and about your relationship with New York then and now.
I mean, it's interesting because the first half of it was written before 9/11, and the second half was written afterwards. And I really do consider, at least in my life, that whole period before 9/11, after 9/11, to be very surreal. Like the whole time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I distinctly remember a foreboding kind of aura around. I really do remember that, and this song is sort of a testament to that sort of, you know, time when really in both my life and I believe in the world at the time, there was really just sort of, it was just very surreal. And 9/11, you know, was, I don't want to say it was anticipated, but it was really kind of, I don't know, I believe that when 9/11 happened, it was kind of, it just represented so much.
It was in the air.
Know? It was in the air, and it was in the psyche, you know, in so many ways.
We'll listen to it. Rufus Wainwright, it's wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
Rufus Wainwright will be playing Saturday night in Wallingford, Connecticut, Sunday in Boston at the Fleet Pavilion, and next Tuesday and Wednesday in New York's Central Park. And we look forward to Want 2 coming out in CD.
By the new year.
We'll be listening on iTunes and waiting for the new album. Terrific to have you. Good luck with your tour. Thanks a lot for being with us.
No problem.
We'll go out with Rufus Wainwright's 11:11. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Woke up this morning and something was burning. Realized that everything does happen in Manhattan. Thoughts were of characters and afternoons lying.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
I am pleased to announce that with your help, the next Vice President of the United States of America will be Senator John Edwards from North Carolina.
We're going to win this election. We're going to make America strong at home. And once again, America will be respected around the world when John Kerry is the President of the United States.
He's being described today as charming, engaging, a nimble campaigner, a populist, and even sexy. How does he stack up against Dick Cheney?
Dick Cheney can be president. Next.
Credible reporting now indicates that Al-Qaeda is moving forward with its plans to carry out a large-scale attack in the United States in an effort to disrupt our democratic process.
We would not have authorized that war. With 75 votes, we knew what we know now. Leading up to September 11th, our government didn't connect the dots. In Iraq, we are even more culpable because the dots themselves never existed.
We don't know how he got there or what went on between the time that he was reported missing from his unit until he got into Lebanon. And he came to the embassy compound and under our control on his own accord.
The court accordingly finds the construction of the war and its associated regime are contrary to international law.
As CEO of the company, I accept responsibility for Enron's collapse, as I've said before. However, that does not mean I knew everything that happened at Enron, and I firmly reject any notion that I engaged in any wrongful or criminal activity.
And there is a week. Democrat John Kerry chooses North Carolina Senator John Edwards as his running mate. President Bush takes a swipe at Kerry's choice of Edwards when asked how he stacks up to Vice President Cheney. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge says Al-Qaeda is planning a terror attack that could hit the U.S. political process in the run-up to November. A Senate intelligence report blasts the CIA over intelligence failures that paved the way for war in Iraq. Senator Jay Rockefeller says even the dots were missing. Marine Corporal Wasif Ali Hassoun turns up at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut after earlier reports had him being killed by captors in Iraq. The International Court of Justice in The Hague rules that the West Bank barrier being constructed by Israel violates international law. And former Enron CEO Kenneth Lay is indicted on 11 counts of fraud but maintains his innocence. Jack Beatty, things heating up on a bunch of fronts here.
They are. And one front that wasn't on the front page, at least today, it's on page 10 of my local paper. Five killed in Iraq, five soldiers, 20 wounded in an attack with 38 mortar rounds on a building in Samarra. Now, think what that means, 38 mortar rounds on one building before they could target these mortars. This is a kind of boldness that is just, the number really struck me. It made the building collapse on these men.
A big number, not even on the front page, and on the day when I think the combined coalition troop death toll has now passed 1,000.
Yes, and also on a day when the Associated Press is quoting a general, an army general, is saying that the resistance, Iraqi resistance, may have as many as 50,000 people in it, most of them indigenous. Meanwhile, the polls show that the public, by 55%, wants to leave either as soon as possible or within 18 months, quote, regardless of the situation at the time. Of course, neither candidate is saying that.
A lot riding on whether or not this new Iraqi government can do something in the next 6 months, and an election there that might put things on a more stable path, maybe bleed some of those 50,000 insurgent fighters away from this effort.
I think that's the hope, that they can either legitimate them and say come into the political process or isolate them. But it's a 50,000 is a pretty scary number of people involved in the resistance.
It is indeed. And, of course, today the Senate Intelligence Committee report out saying that the very basis for the war, as laid out by the U.S. Intelligence Committee, flawed from front to back.
Yes. You know, what bothered me about the report is that it's split on party lines, the minority document. You know, they can't agree on the same set of facts, so they spin them differently. I think the 9/11 Commission is almost bound to do the same thing now. In fact, conservatives have referred to it as the Zelikow Report. That is, it's the report of the staff, not the report of the commissioners. And I think those are going to split along party lines, and essentially there'll be, you know, two claims for the truth, as usual on these things.
And yet, even with that split, their condemnation of the intelligence was fairly thorough today, right across party lines.
It was indeed, and Pat Roberts, on the chairman of the committee, senator from Kansas, on NPR this afternoon, was asked, "Well, knowing if you knew all this, that there were none of these, that this intelligence was all bad, would you have voted for the war?" And the man, he said, "I'm not sure." Now, that's quite a statement. And Mr. Bush is going to be asked that, and Mr. Kerry, too. And we'll have to hear how they respond. Well,
Bush, Kerry, Edwards, all very prominent out on the campaign trail this week. Kerry Edwards, of course, kicking off their dynamic duo. But President Bush, not the least bit shy this week. In fact, more evident than he's been in a while.
Yes, and I watched a forum he had today in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, with small businessmen, and it was a bravura performance. He did not consult notes. He barely read from the speech. His voice was intimate, and he basically kept making market arguments for lowering taxes. You lower the small business man gets more money. What does he do with it? He points to the audience. He hired you, didn't he? And what do? Well, you spend your money at the village, and that moves down the economy. You're doing more with your money than we can do with it in Washington. And then he went right from that thread to free trade, another shot at the rhetoric of the Democrats. He went, and he brought up somebody on his tax cut. He said, you know, $1,250 doesn't sound like much in Washington, but I'll bet it's a lot to you, isn't it? The people shake their heads. He's back on his game, and the idea that he's just going to sort of roll over here, or that he's going to remain as frozen as he was early in the year, he's fighting, and on today's performance, fighting very well.
And a clear line out of the Democrat camp, Jack?
One thing, Gore got a bounce of 19 points, but according to polls, Edwards' bounce is only 9. So, woof, I don't know what that says.
Well, we'll be watching. Jack, thanks so much. Good to have you tonight. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.